And then the last issue is the issue of the healthy newborn. And the question being, if we reported healthy newborns, we're implying there's a risk of unhealthy. And does that shine a light on something and mean that we'll pay attention to what's on the unhealthy side? Or does it have other unintended consequences? So that's where we are. Let me start on the very first
one. Frank?
I'm sorry, someone on the
yeah. phone? Yeah, hi, Tom James. Wonder if I could raise my card.
You're up.
Okay. Realizing that half of my academic training is in pediatrics, and so I have attended a number of sections and vaginal deliveries, and I've got a bias towards 476. But as I mentioned yesterday, I have heard from obstetricians that they've got concerns about this for patient safety. And as I did, and Tom, realizing what Tom Ballack said about trying to do balancing measures would create a new conundrum. And as I did a literature search last night and found articles that go both directions about the validity of this, I think that it would be important if we institute this measure that there be a concomitant study rather than a balancing measure to prove the safety.
Tom, could you clarify which measure again?
I'm sorry. This is 468.9. I'll get new glasses. It was 469, the elective delivery to 39 weeks.
But so you're in support with a caveat?
I'm in support with a caveat, and I'm not going to make the recommendation I did yesterday for a balancing measure, but to have that the measure developer have an ongoing study to prove the safety.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So let's go back to the very first one, the process measures, and ask the group, where are you on these process measures? There's the antibiotic measure and the DVT measure, or the VTE measure. To include in the safety set or are not. It doesn't mean they go away, but it means we're not recommending them as part of the measures for safety and the family of safety. I go to the outcome measures, and there are on the outcome page the C-section, the under 1,500 gram infant, and the 39-week gestation measure. And I'm hearing to consensus tending toward inclusion of all three.
I do not support those first two being included.
Okay. Richard?
The concern was the third one that Tom just mentioned is that it pushes the obstetrician to wait too long to do a C-section. So that in the spirit of trying not to do a section, that they'll wait too long. I mean, that is the concern that the paper's writing about.
Richard?
Mindful of what Andrea said about the fact that we don't have a goal for one of these, for 477, I don't think I can support it because we don't really know what we're trying to strive for.
So you're not in favor of 477?
I am not.
Okay.
Aren't we trying to strive for babies being delivered in safer settings? I mean, you want them to be at a higher level of care if they're that small, right? Isn't that a goal in itself?
But we don't know what the optimum level is. That's the problem. And if there's a huge difference between urban and non-urban, I think we have to take that into account. I don't know if the measure does that or not. There are just realities of patient populations that sometimes have these babies born in a less than ideal setting, but that's just the reality.
Amy?
Those will come up in our next discussion. Even areas where we can't say the goal is zero, I think can be useful for comparative purposes. And I'm not saying just A to B, but kind of looking at broader pools of, you know, this group is doing this well, this group is doing that well, and looking, you know, that might even drive looking for best practices. So I don't know that I'm necessarily fighting for this measure, but I'm saying that just because we don't say the goal is zero doesn't mean it's not worth it, that we don't, just because we don't know the ideal rate right now.
Dana, you're about to.
Yes, I was just going to say on the 1,500 gram again, I mean, the birth centers of the various hospitals or facilities that are designated birth centers has a designation status of this level 1, 2, or 3, which would define out for them whether or not a 1,500-gram baby would be appropriate to deliver. But you're right. I mean, sometimes you know, they appear on your doorstep, and you've got to do what you can do. I just don't know how if there is an issue where there's a breach of this in terms of, you know, hospital facilities. And it sounds like, Andrea, you have some information for urban facilities where they're not following, possibly the protocol or, you know, standards of service. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's we're trying to be a little too perfect in this measure, and I think the expectation is not zero. You know, whether it's the birth of a child or if it's the rupturing of a great vessel, if it happens on your doorstep, you're not going to say, sorry, the measure won't allow me to treat you. You're going to do what you can. And yet the goal is that you have the connectivity to the right system to get the patient to the right place, if possible. I don't think that's a bad thing to measure. We are measuring that here. That's exactly what we're measuring.
I mean, let's say you have, you're in an area where a lot of people don't get great prenatal care, and they show up and deliver on your doorstep or whatever the example is, or they have a lot of, you know, AAA, whatever the equivalent example is. You're not really measuring your connectivity. You're measuring how many of those patients at high risk who come in late to deliver. You may, in part, be measuring your connectivity, but you're not necessarily measuring that. If you want to measure connectivity, then you need to measure around those things. I mean, that's where I'm just reflecting what the voting draft, the comments had been in the committee that had reviewed this measure. I don't know that we necessarily know. I don't know. We don't necessarily know in this room right now what the pitfalls are, whether it's poor delivery system or lots of women who come in. Because you would have actually expected it to be the other way around if it was that it would have been rural areas. But rural areas, they probably have it all set up so they can get these, you know, women out. And then an urban area where there's just more people. I'm speculating now. So I just don't think that we know the answer.
Isn't that good information?
Can I jump in on the phone?
Please identify yourself.
This is Foster Gessen from New York.
Please go ahead, Foster.
Sorry to intrude. If I could raise my card somehow telephonically, I would. I think that I'm not going to make a comment pro or con around this measure. I think that there are pluses and minuses, and we've used this measure, and there are plenty of measures where the correct answer or the the probable answer isn't going to be 100% or zero, but I don't think that, I think as Frank and others have said, it doesn't make it not useful. I think the biggest question I have around this measure is what the accountable entity is. And I think it does measure something around a system of care and getting people to the right place at the right time. But I think I have more questions about its use as a specific measure for a hospital or a provider or for pay for performance or, thinking about the overall context of measures for the MAP than I do about the pros and cons of the measure themselves. And maybe, somebody can articulate a way in which they think it's clear as a specific accountability measure for a particular provider system. That's the part I think that I'm a little bit hung up on. But I just want to say I'm full support of the other two outcome measures. I think that those are really primary and very important.
Thank you, Foster. Heidi, have you got anything to clarify on level of analysis on this one? And while we're doing that, Bill?
Just to build on what Foster said, that was a helpful comment, consistent with my own thoughts. It seems like there's a thread here. Hopefully I'm not misinterpreting, but here the thread is a concern by the part of some people about should the hospital be held responsible for the performance on these measures. I heard that from Nancy's concern about the healthy term newborn. I heard that in Richard's concern about the 477 and also Andrea's concern. Those are legitimate concerns. I'm concerned on the flip side here is that's true of many, many things, many, many health conditions, many, many things that happen in hospitals are affected by what happens before and after. We've had this discussion around readmissions. I'm concerned about going down the path of saying, like, if the hospital doesn't have complete control of all the variables that might affect this measure, then we shouldn't be reporting it. I think, if we go down that path, we end up with not having very many measures of what happens in the hospital. These are really important measures from a patient perspective. I assume they're also important for clinicians. And I can't imagine we wouldn't want to publish, perhaps with appropriate caveats or risk adjustments and so on, these four key outcome measures. C-section rate, very important from a safety issue as well as cost issue. Where the patient's delivered at a hospital that can handle low birth weight infants. The elective delivery prior to 39 weeks, and also the healthy term newborn. As I think Ron said earlier, like, that's the ultimate outcome measure. I can't imagine we wouldn't recommend that those things be reported. Understand that they need to be, that these issues about accountability need to be dealt with, but we shouldn't go down the path of simply saying, well, since we can't control everything that might affect this outcome, then we shouldn't report it.
Dan?
I just wanted, from the rural perspective, wanted to reiterate the comments about showing up at your doorstep. I know anecdotally of a lot of stories of infants being delivered in small rural hospitals. A lot of times it's transportation issues. It's a snowstorm or an ice storm or whatever, and they just can't get anywhere else.
Lynn?
Just want to add some clarification to PC01. Number 0469, it does have some exclusion criteria for this measure. What it does is it excludes patients with diagnosis codes that justify elective delivery. So this is really geared towards, you know, clamping down on those truly elective deliveries, whether it's the patient's choice or the doctor's choice. So in my mind, this outcome measure really is supposed to get to zero.
Well, I mean, you wanted to. I have a lot of experience with this one measure in our own community, and it's a huge safety issue for us. And we moved the practice in a woman's hospital from between 37 and 39 weeks, and we had a 20% reduction in NICU admissions. We reduced infant mortality. We reduced wet baby, wet long, wet brain. Just by going the extra mile, so to speak. And it was a massively huge safety issue. It totally destroyed the hospital resources in the NICU and had to go back to the business model with the health plans to fix it. But it was so the right thing to do for patients. Now, that said, this is not so easy a measure, because we just can't figure out when pregnancy began. And it's so hard. So it's kind of a best guess measure is where, that's its limitations, the best we can do. And so even then, we've dramatically improved baby outcomes and had no difference in mother outcomes, maternal outcomes, but baby outcomes were unbelievable. So I support this as a safety measure. C-section, I'm not so sure that's a safety measure issue. I mean, every time you do any procedure, there are events that happen, but I don't think this is overwhelmingly a safety measure. I think this measure has other implications, and we see rates that are just escalating, and they're escalating for all the wrong reasons, and I'm not sure putting it on the safety list fixes those problems. So I'm not really in favor of fixing this as a safety measure. I think there's a whole other sector of the economy that needs to be taken out and quartered and told that, you know, you're having an impact on C-section rates, and that's not the right investing to do for the mothers and babies of the country. But I'm not convinced that this is going to change what's being forced from another avenue, and I struggle with that one. But I just have to tell you my story with the 39-weeker. It's a real story, and it was unbelievable to hear what it did to those babies. Richard?
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to Bill, and I'm sympathetic to what you're saying. I do believe that hospitals need to be accountable in many ways, and that if we certainly hospitals don't control all of the variables. The patients that come in the door are the patients you receive, and that's why we have risk adjustment. We try to level the playing field. But I'm concerned that there are some areas that have complex societal longstanding problems that include access to care and healthcare literacy. And for lack of any other party, we want to hold the hospital accountable for that. And then at the same time, we're reluctant to recognize the fact that the hospitals treat different patient populations because we want to expose disparities, which I agree with. But then we put these into public reporting and payment, and that's the problem. And I don't know that it's appropriate to reward and penalize when we don't know really if we're rewarding and penalizing quality or a patient population or the fact that the community has no access to care. So that's why I find that measure a little bit different from the others.
So I don't know if we're getting a little bit of scope creep on this one. It's a really good discussion, and I'm on the safety net side of this, where in my real practice, this is life. And we do everything we can to shine a light on this because it's our only chance of getting the resources to fix it, as opposed to trying to say, well, I don't want to be misclassified and penalized. I'm not so sure we understand how the rest of the payor system will use this and make the wrong move. And if we say that this measure is a critical measure if applied appropriately, you may dramatically improve the health and safety of the newborn. And I think that's, in my world, that's very true. So I'm not at all afraid of looking at this as a system, as a hospital system. I'm dying to do this. I want to go out to the hospitals who are plagued with these babies who they don't have the resources to take care of them and say, I'm here. I'm right here. And that's the connectivity I want. And so we can't always be worried about the worst consequence, but stating our concern may be an appropriate concern. Apply this measure realizing you can misclassify, misuse, and do harm, but if you properly apply this measure, you can make a difference in the safety of these babies.
Excellent point, and I really believe we should shine a light on it. I guess once burnt, twice shy, as the expression. So let's just make sure we don't misuse it, but we use it appropriately.
So I've kind of stepped out of my chair role here, but I'm protecting babies now. So I'm a grandfather. I got to do that. I want to come back to this, but let's just take a break, get lunch, come back, and we'll work through lunch with this. So about 10, 15 minutes, and we'll work right through lunch, kind of get started quickly because we're getting behind. But I think this has been a very important discussion. While you're eating, just looking and reflecting on the obstetric measures we've been talking about, we've got several outcome measures on the table. And I want to keep the infection measures for the last part of this discussion right now. But the healthy newborn, and then the other three, the C-section, the under 1500 grammar, and the elective delivery. It seems like elective delivery we have consensus. So if I can put that one behind us, then I'm asking about C-section rate, obviously important. Is it a safety measure, or is it something that another work group has to address? And kind of to Tom and Connie, is this going to get lost, or is there another work group likely to address this? Let me put it that way. And then the 1,500-gram infant, where do we stand with that one? So healthy baby, 1,500-grammer, C-section are the three outcomes we're talking about. Amy?
I guess for the C-section, I could see maybe making a play to move that to kind of safety-related overuse. If our thought is that, you know, it's kind of a potentially overused procedure in some situations, I could see that it would kind of fall in with the other things in that area. I don't know which it falls into, but I'm not sure that it would entirely remove it from the realm of patient safety or the family of patient.
I mean, any operation has unintended consequences to it, but C-section is not known to be a highly unsafe procedure.
I mean, I think it falls into safety because the babies have a much higher percent chance of coming out with, you know, their lungs don't get squeezed out, so to speak, so they come out with more respiratory problems potentially, and I think there may also be some glucose issues. Certainly the respiratory problems are the issue, and that's why it's a safety. I think that's probably, I mean, in my mind, that's why it's a safety issue. The glucose things, I'm not remembering. I could pull up. It says it at the beginning of that measure spec. There's a whole big paragraph on it and why it's a safety thing. I can find that measure spec.
Okay. While you're doing that, Helen?
I just wanted to make the point, and I was really thinking about a bloodstream infection when I won't go there, but I just wanted to make the point that of all the patient choice that people have, obstetrics is the main one, and they can visit the hospitals. They spend a lot of time choosing their providers for delivery, and we want, you know, they need to have safety as part of that choice. I mean, it really is cheating people to have them not have as much of this information as we can give them. So, you know, bloodstream infections, all of this data, I think is really important for patient choice.
Okay. Phil?
You said we could top our eating, is that right?
Yeah, I was going to say, did I just catch you with your mouth?
That wild rice is good, though, I have to say. I just like to talk about PCO2's C-section rate. I understand completely where you're coming from, Frank, that this isn't primarily a safety issue. So, from what I know clinically, from what Andrew said, this is a safety, has a safety component. This is a big issue, though, and I'm concerned if this falls off the list because it doesn't quite fit in our family. I mean, all families have some members who don't look like the rest and fit in the family mold, but I'm a little concerned that this might become an orphan if it doesn't get included in safety, and we wouldn't know quite what family to put it in. And I don't want it to wait until next year when the appropriateness cost group tries to address it. This is very important as a measure for particularly among commercial and commercially insured patients. That's why it often doesn't get enough attention from CMS. If we're going to do public-private partnerships effectively, we're going to align with the priorities of the National Priorities Partnership, something has to come out of MAP that says this has to be publicly reported. And if it doesn't come from the safety group, safety family, it needs to come from some other family. And if we can't find another family, then we just ought to accept this one as a member of our family.
Tom, Connie, is there another family that this could potentially move to?
Yeah, so this could potentially be a part of
the affordability family. The overuse aspect has been mentioned. I would point out that HHS asked us, because affordability isn't coming until next year, they asked us to consider the cost implications of all the families we're working on this year. So Amy's point, without knowing that we were asked to do that, went right to, and it's actually our whole next category is on, went right to that relationship. And so if you all can see your way clearer to the relationship between the safety aspects that Andrea mentioned related to cesarean section and the fact that it is a highly overused procedure, then I think we could accept Bill's logic that it does fit in this family, at least as an adoptee, if not clearly a natural born child.
Dan?
So I do see that there is a very strong component of the C-section for a safety component. You know, because respiratory distress syndrome is probably the highest complication rate, for the neonate as a result of C-section. And then this overuse or appropriateness of C-sections that, unfortunately out there that sometimes that C-sections are performed when, there should have been given more time for a vaginal birth. So I think that the measure is important, whether we keep it here in safety or by hearing that suggested maybe moving it to another area.
Richard?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's low quality care, and it could be on several dimensions. It's not safe care. It's not patient-centered care. It's not effective care. It's not efficient care. So you could put it into any one of those four buckets, but it should be definitely placed somewhere. And I also would say, mindful of Frank's comments about transparency, I do think we need to be transparent with the measure of the low birth weight infants, as long as we can caveat this appropriately as you suggested.
To that measure, Richard, Heidi, can you give us any clarifying specs on that one?
So we're talking 477.
477.
Okay, so that is level of analysis is its facility, health plan, and then basically it's county, city, region, state, office. But the lowest level of facility, health plan.
Okay. I've got Nancy, then Barbara.
Oh, I won't fight strongly against it, but I have to say, I think as long as I've been working in healthcare, people have been talking about C-sections and talking about C-section rates, and yet publicizing C-section rates has not moved the dial one bit. However, as Frank spoke earlier about the early term elective deliveries, which includes a lot of C-sections, the momentum around reducing those, the clear indications of patient safety. Frank's story of the effectiveness of reducing the population of the NICU because so many babies no longer need that NICU service when they're carried to term. That's a story I'm hearing from hospitals all over the country that are adopting this. I think that's an enormous opportunity, and I would put our focus and attention on that measure and reducing those early elective deliveries, recognizing that that will have significant implications for reducing C-section rates as well, much more effectively than anything I've seen on C-sections before.
Barbara?
Yeah, I just want to endorse the C-section. It's a disclosure.
Thank you. Andrea?
Ditto.
All right, so the consensus, I think, is emerging, and Lance is going to help us with that.
Just one last comment. Looking at NPP's input to the National Quality Strategy, they also list the cesarean section on low-risk women within the national priority in making care affordable. Just want to bring that to light. And, of course, inappropriate maternity care is listed in the safe care national priority. So it's listed in two different places.
So what I'm hearing is that at least on this one page, we are looking at all three outcomes, a caveated 477 to the discussion that we've had. And the last one I have before we talk about what to do with the infectious codes is the healthy newborn, which is on the next page. Andrea?
Can we put a caveat with that PCO2? I mean, I'm definitely not really in favor of that metric, but certainly if it's going to get recommended, I just think that contraindication, this is a metric that's based on coding, so it'll be dependent on coding practices, and the contraindication list is limited. I think that has to be re-reviewed as part of this, but that needs to at least, if we're going to recommend that, which I'm not really in favor of, but if we are, then that contraindication list has to be really robust.
Thank you for reminding me, and I want all of you to know that the whole team here is really trying to capture all these comments, we're not just trying to hit the codes and that's it, and we're trying to capture those specific comments that are invaluable to the report. So those are getting in, and I really appreciate you highlighting it, particularly if you think we need to stress one. So thanks for doing that. That will be there. So healthy babies. Helen, I think you had said this one was one interested you.
I like it, but I have a question. I do think that in terms of decision-making, it would be more helpful for patients to have complication rates rather than success rates. Are there no measures for adverse birth outcomes?
You see them in like these infection measure sets. There's not an aggregate measure like this. This gets to the aggregate measure by giving you the healthy baby. It gives you the inverse. But it doesn't tell you who's low risk, who's high risk. It doesn't stratify that. And those measures that stratify are usually high risk stratified and a specific outcome, like an infection. So this is kind of a much broader view and doesn't give you the kind of detail. It's just shining a light on the fact that this city, this facility, this area has this kind of a healthy baby rate.
I think it's helpful information. I think the other is even more helpful, but I realize that would be a lot of measures if they exist.
Richard?
You know, I guess the problem with this measure as I think about it is you're kind of looking for records where there's been no evidence, and not all evidence is equal, so I might have a small defect, and it counts the same as if I've had a significant respiratory compromise at birth, and so I don't really like it. I don't think it's very discriminating, and then further, I think you can see this with all ICD-9 coding, but it does reward sort of non-reporting, because I guess the easiest way to be in there is just not to code anything, and you'll end up as a healthy baby. So I guess I'm not that in favor of this measure.
So we've actually heard a couple comments on the counterbalancing side that to this point about discrimination, does it really give you helpful, actionable data, or does it just kind of leave you with a, yeah, so what does that mean? Bill?
In terms of actionable data within a hospital, this may not be a very useful measure, but this is for public reporting and in terms of information for consumers when choosing what hospital be a good hospital to go to for deliveries, in terms of purchasers looking for what hospitals and what their health plans they have in their network. And to health plans as well. It seems to me it's a good, very simple, meaningful measure for consumers and purchasers, and that's why it's attractive
from my perspective, for public reporting. It's of all the hundreds of measures we've been looking at the last several days, like, we're going to pick, like, one measure that's simple, meaningful, that everybody gets. This might be the one. Again, it's more useful for lay people, not so much for physicians and hospital administrators or health experts. But I think it has a lot of appeal, and it's on that basis. And it has gotten quite a good bit of good use in California. Again, it may not be well known around the country, but I think PBGH was involved in this one. I'd be glad to share more information about that, see how it's been used, and to address some of the questions, concerns that people might have.
Bill, you just gave me a great idea for our next meeting. Everyone gets a special one safety code coin. You only get to play that once, and it's your trump card. Nancy?
So I'm looking at this measure, and I'm thinking about the discussion we just had around the very small birth weight babies. I don't know the data on this from California, but my guess is, unless these specifications are a whole lot better than I'm seeing from the brief description here on Lance's computer, thank you, Lance, that in fact, we're going to be telling people that it's really good to go to those hospitals that have a lot of healthy babies, but they're not the ones that you send the very low birth weight infants to because they have unhealthy babies. Well, what's the message? Now, do you want people to go to the right level of care, or do you want people to go to some place where they don't have a lot of babies that are born small or with known complications or other things that you get in your level 3 NICU? So I think it sounds appealing. I think it is a whole lot less appealing in reality than you think it's going to be.
So I think the curse of a poor discrimination is that you run the risk of misclassification. I think that's what you're saying, and I agree with you. Richard?
I personally have never seen any data with using this measure, and as it plays out in reality, that's how I know whether it works effectively or not.
So we're losing you to the rest of the crowd, so the folks on the phone won't get to hear you. Richard?
I guess it's just an amplification. I think this measure is missing two things. One is some component of risk adjustment, and the second is a classification of the complications. I've just looked at inpatient complications, and I can tell you that there are maybe 86 ICD-9 codes that really impact mortality or length of stay or cost in a meaningful way, and then there's a huge tail, which are complications, but they don't have much of an impact. I think we need to look at them. I'm not saying dismiss them, but if you just throw them all into one bucket and say these are all equal, it's not a healthy baby, I don't think it's helpful.
So, in the spirit of trying to move us forward, I think we're at a point where we need more information. And perhaps in the weeks ahead, we can find some information to get you to react to specific to this measure. But I don't have consensus. So I'm not going to take it off the table. I'm going to leave it for us to see if we can't find something more meaningful for you, specifically out of California, and bring that back to you to react to. And we'll just put this one in a parking lot because it has, as Bill said, for him, he'd play his card on this one. It's a high level of importance, but there's enough concern about its potential for misinterpretation, misuse, not so much on payment, but on the impact it could have on patients. So let's leave that and come back to it. Fair enough? We have the sepsis project, which will be in the future, and we have three codes here that are related to infection in the newborn. And the question is there
a need to hold these for our sepsis effort, or do we need to choose one of these now? And we bring it forward because Helen brought it to our attention that this is very important to her and to the patients that she sees and represents. So where are we on these three sepsis, the Vermont, Oxford, and then the two claim space, the ARC and the TJC, the claim space effort? Okay. I know, just recalling our previous discussion, Andre had made some great points about the concerns over the validity, reliability of claims-based measures and the need for getting input from Chesley about how we could actually use other infectious recording sources other than perhaps the Vermont Oxford Index. I've got Amy and then Anne-Marie.
I'm just wondering if we can verify that that Joint Commission one is claims-based. I thought that was medical record abstraction.
Can you give me a number? I'm afraid to tell you the wrong thing. 1731 is administrative claims.
Emory?
When we looked at the infections on the adult side, we were using the NHSN. They looked back, almost all of them used that. So I think for some level of consistency, you know, you don't want to be splitting how you're balancing infections in one place and how you're doing it in the other. So maybe you should wait on these and see if there's some way that we can get, as what Andrea's saying, some data that makes more sense and not be using the claims data. Because they're not using it for those other infections that we had in the beginning on the adult side, the CLADSEAS, et cetera, the NHSN.
And it's not that it goes away. We're bumping this down the road to another session. We're not saying we won't address these. We're addressing these later if we don't address them today. Richard?
I agree with something Andrew said earlier, which is that the Vermont-Oxford network is an optional network that not all hospitals use. And in order to get these standardized rates and standardized morbidity rates, you'd need to really have that software. And so, to me, this isn't a viable option because we've really been sort of mandating that everybody go out and use this, which I don't think is what we want to do.
Is there any sense of the penetration and use?
I mean, I don't know the numbers, but my default is that all the big players, you know, the big places where you have NICUs, level three kinds of things, are using Vermont Oxford. There's another collaborative that comes out of the Children's Hospital Association that's a neonatal collaborative. Those are the two big neonatal collaboratives that are going on. And, you know, I'd be, you know, there's very few places that aren't going
to
be.
So these are high-risk babies to begin with who are likely to be in those places. So we're probably talking about more than 80% of these babies that would fall into this category. So it's a pretty high number, and I think that was part of the design of the measure. That if you went to the low risk babies, you're not picking them all up because they're not in the network.
I think the piece of investigation that would need to be clarified a little bit more is that Vermont Oxford is a registry like many of these registries. So in some ways, when you look at some of these other kinds of measures that people have been doing for a long time for public reporting and whatnot, the rigor of the data collection, the rigor of the data specifications is really impressive, right? So these measures that have been reported for a long time to CMS that have very well-developed measure specifications and extremely well-developed processes for data collection and auditing the data collection. When you get into these registries that are not in that line of work, the rigor around the data collection is different. So if you're talking about things in STS or in Vermont Oxford, or I'm scared to say any of the surgical ones, because Frankel, you know. But when you get, you know, there's a different level of rigor depending on the registry, I'll just put it that way. And so, and also probably depending on the metric, even within the registry, metrics that people are more interested in, they may do a better job of collecting the data. So there's certain things within Vermont Oxford that I think people probably do a really good job, a really rigorous job around the data collection, and there may be things that they don't do as good of a job. I think there would need to be some input from them around sort of the rigor of that metric.
My question to the group is, you know, hearing this dialogue, would it be reasonable to consider 304? And that's kind of the placeholder for this. And when we go into sepsis downstream, we can come back and review the neonatal sepsis and where we stand and what those measures are going forward.
I mean, I would rather wait, Frank, because I would rather have us take a look at the Vermont Oxford Central Line Associated Bloodstream Infection metric. I'm not sure why that one. I don't know. I'm not totally clear on why this one versus that one. Unless they're the same. I thought there was a separate one. We look at our, you know, at our central line associated bloodstream infections in neonates. So I would like us to wait and delineate
those.
Is
that an endorsed measure, Tino?
Oh, maybe it's not endorsed. Maybe that's the problem.
No, they only put forward the sepsis. I'll look again, but I don't think they did.
So maybe what we could do as part of the sepsis work, if that's imminent, is also say we're going to take a good look at the central line associated bloodstream infection metrics with that. I mean, that's, I don't know why what the hang-ups. I don't know the issues there, but
okay.
I would rather have
it. So let's identify that one as a gap. Helen?
I guess my question is why there would be a problem with the administrative data here. I see it already says high risk, so they're already stratifying. And it's a question of presence or absence in the administrative data. I think it's a fairly straightforward, and claim what I like about that is it's broader, it's more comprehensive, it captures more facilities, and it doesn't, it's just not a complicated measure with all of these things hedging it in, like the Vermont Oxford, and it's with the administrative data, it can be done in any hospital.
Again, you're down to you have three measures, two of which are very similar and one is slightly different. They're probably all the same hospitals.
You're talking about the Vermont?
The high-risk newborns are for the most part, going to be all in the same hospitals. So we're coming close to measuring the same small number of facilities who are doing this. And the question is, if we're pretty much measuring high-risk neonates, for the most part, it's going to be in a subset of hospitals that fit Vermont, and whether we do it with Vermont data, ARC data, or TJC data. But I would look at it as the Venn diagrams of the three hospitals have a lot of the three measures have a lot of hospital overlap. They're all pretty much the same.
But, again, if we're talking about individuals trying to make choices, if they're concerned about the particular. I mean, I think we would want something that would capture all of these babies.
Well, so
not just a sample of them.
I'm talking about 90% of these babies in all three of these measures.
Right, right. No, I understand that.
So they're the same. But one is late sepsis and meningitis, one's bloodstream from ARC, one's bloodstream from TJC. So in the spirit of parsimony, which one of those three?
I like the ARC and the TJC. I don't see much difference between those two, but I prefer those two.
Okay.
I like the ARC. It's just because it's more inclusive.
Okay. Not hearing consensus again. Well, we don't have consensus to move forward with one of these measures, so I think it's time we leave them for our sepsis discussion. And if in the meantime we find more clarifying data, we can bring it forward. So let's move on. We've got safety-related overuse, and this is, I guess I'm on page 27, is that right? And we've got three commenters in this area, Ron and Helen and Randy. Helen, do you want to begin? Oh, I'm sorry, it's Amy. I'm looking at the wrong spot. Amy and Kevin. Did we lose Kevin? All right. Amy?
Okay. So I found one of the most challenging things with this area is these are all kind of very specific by nature because we're looking at specific instances of overuse. I relied heavily on the Choosing Wisely campaign and kind of the things that they had come up with and identified as major areas of overuse. This is kind of what I came up with. We had three measures kind of looking at low back pain imaging, which was mentioned by a couple of the Choosing Wisely areas, more than one. And between the measures, when I look at 0052 versus 0315, 0315 seemed to maybe be more in line with what Choosing Wisely had come up with, simply because it specifies the 6 weeks, whereas the other one didn't. 0312 appears to be about repeat imaging studies instead of that initial imaging study. If it somehow captured initial, that's a nice measure. I like it. It seems more complete, but I'd rather capture the initial. I think that's probably the bigger problem. The inappropriate pulmonary CT imaging for patients at low risk of pulmonary embolism is 0667. That was also mentioned by multiple groups in the Choosing Wisely campaign. So that would be one that I would like to see. The prostate cancer avoidance of overuse of bone scan was mentioned in the Choosing Wisely campaign. It seemed like it might be slightly more narrow than the others, although I'm not sure. the appropriate testing for children with pharyngitis was one that I liked, even though it wasn't in the Choosing Wisely. It kind of gets to that antibiotics and children's area.
Sorry, which measure was that one?
Sorry, I didn't give a number, did I?
02.
I also like the, for a similar reason, the appropriate treatment for children with upper respiratory infection. I think that's probably a really common area of overuse, even though it didn't come up in the Choosing Wisely campaign. So similar, given the issue that we saw earlier with the adverse drug events associated with the use of corticosteroids, that kind of bumped up the otitis with diffusion, the systemic corticosteroids, the 0656, it made me wonder if maybe that's because of the potential for the ADEs with that medication, if that makes up a higher priority. And then the overuse for the two colonoscopy, although I wonder if those could maybe possibly be combined, the 0658 and the 0659. What did come out of the Choosing Wisely campaign, it seemed like there were several areas that were mentioned that aren't covered by the measures on the set in terms of gaps. Antibiotics for sinusitis was mentioned by multiple groups. There were multiple groups in multiple settings where cardiac testing was mentioned, EKGs, either pre-op, annual, follow-up, stress cardiac imaging was mentioned several times. And chest x-rays as inappropriate use was mentioned several times. I don't know that there are measures in those areas, but those are potential future developments.
Great. Thank you. Kevin? Did you have a chance to look at the measures? And
I did. And so a number of these measures are actually proposed in the proposed rule for meaningful use. So I have both sort of an overview look as well as some work knowledge of what it takes to specify these. And then that's the ONC, has a contract with RAND Corporation to do some work on efficiency measure identification of key concepts. And so we've had a number of expert panels and input, and these actually overlap quite a bit with the efficiency measures that we've been thinking about in that circumstance. What I can say is that I really also like the low back pain, especially 0052. My electronic health record focus lets me know that 0312 has been impossible to e-specify because the red flag symptoms are not things that are charted in the kind of detail that would be necessary for e-specification, and that would actually create a whole lot of new documentation that would be required in order to capture that. So although the conceptually as a measure concept, I like it, but as a specific measure, it's one that has not proven to be e-specifiable. I similarly like the overuse measures of the CT imaging for patients at low risk for PE, and the head CT, I agree, the head CT for mild traumatic brain injury is a nice measure. The melanoma overutilization measure, again, what there was exploration and e-specification of that one, and that one was very, very difficult to e-specify. I had a lot of feasibility problems, so from my particular view of e-specification, that one was hard. The avoidance and overuse of bone scan is something that is in the proposed rule, and that one is it's a very common cancer, and it's had a lot of expert panels endorse it in our process, and so I'll echo their recommendation. The testing for, or the appropriate use for children with pharyngitis, appropriate testing for children with pharyngitis. I like, it's had a couple of challenges in a testing framework, but it's basically tested fairly well. And then the adults with acute bronchitis, avoidance of inappropriate use. The challenge that all of these have had from e-measure specification, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but we're really driving the documentation of this right up to the very front line. And when we do that, the exceptions become challenging to require capture by frontline people in a consistent way that can be captured across all organizations. So any of these that say that they're appropriate except in, or it's inappropriate except in these circumstances, it's except in these circumstances that gets really, really hard to figure out. And so the more kind of straightforward the measure is, with the less complexity of exception or population definition, the more straightforward it is to put into a federal program, especially one that requires clinicians to chart it. I also like the 0309, the appropriate use of epidural steroid injections. And the two, I agree that the two around otitis media could potentially be rolled into one. I'm trying to remember the expert panel thought around these was that they were that this had been less of a problem in recent times, and so that this was maybe not something to focus as much energy on. But as not being a pediatrician, I won't comment on that other than to try to reflect what our expert panels have said.
Great. Thank you very much. As the group thinks about these, it's whenever you get into appropriateness, it really, particularly when it involves invasive things like radiation or even a procedure of some sort, we get into the pure level of appropriateness versus the risk of harm or safety. So how, I don't want to say that I know how to balance that, because everything we do to people puts them at risk and the safety implications of it, but how do you put that on the scale of justice and come out on one side or the other in these measures? So let's start with, on the first page, neither of you really mentioned much about the use of contrast in thoracic CT. So that was more an appropriateness issue and not much of a safety issue, or?
So that is one that it's hard to know what the impact is if we're going to pick something that seems to be one, to my mind, that may have less impact than some others. And it faces, again, this clinician judgment match to test that we struggle to capture.
Thank you. That's a great point. And so I'm going to leave that one unless someone wants to pull it back in. And that allows us to turn and get into low back pain. And so I'm wondering, you know, given the importance and the prevalence of low back pain, is it one, two, or, you know, three of these measures that are put up here? And I appreciate your comments about the complexity of what red flags mean. And it looks like there are two measures, Kevin. When I look at the 312 and 315, are both
correct?
Okay. So and you would favor
52.
52 because of its simplicity. All right. So if that is acceptable, Amy, you're questioning? Okay. So I'm thinking about holding 52 and realizing there's value in the other two, but there's complexity to making those effectively put into E-systems.
And I would say that even in an abstraction, you aren't guaranteed that in a standard, in a note, that those things are well documented. And so even as an abstraction measure, they would face some data consistency challenges, I would think.
Okay. Amy?
I guess one point I would make, it looks like the other two are not age-limited, and this one is age-limited. I'd be curious to see if it would be worthwhile to expand it to maybe a broader age population.
The 52? 52.
So it excludes over 50 in the right-hand column?
All of these are the same developer and the same set of measures, so okay. Same ages would apply across all of them.
Okay. So then, I'm not sure I understand that. Due to clinical ignorance, why are we excluding over 50? Is this the workforce low back pain? Do you remember?
It's been a long time since these have been reviewed. It's at least 2 years, so my memory is not honestly failing me. I cannot tell you. I can look and see if I can find the forms from before.
So we would be accepting this measure but would want further clarification about the opportunity to expand the age and why we wouldn't. Okay? Then if I could move just to the inappropriate pulmonary CT for PE. And both of you seemed in favor of this measure. And hearing no resistance. I've got then two trauma measures on this page. One is the appropriateness of head CT, and the other is cervical spine CT imaging. Cervical excludes 65 and older, and I would want to understand why we are not expanding that. So they're keeping these. All right. We've also kept Richard?
When it says
documented indication consistent with guidelines. Was that something you could specify with the measures?
So these have a specific clinical tools that they ask people to chart about that give them a risk. So, for example, the Glasgow Coma Scale would be an example of such a tool. So those are more straightforward to require in an e-specification. They're not necessarily universally required, but unless there's a red flag, which is not currently a tool, that's just a set of measure specifications that are based on clinical judgment in a consensus-based way. Something like the Glasgow Coma Scale or a PE risk score is actually a tool that's often used in clinical practice, certainly not universally used, but it and sometimes is charted.
So we've got the two traumas that nobody is objected to, and that moves us into the melanoma overstaging imaging. And these were a broad set of procedures or imaging events. Is that correct, Heidi? Chest X-ray, CT, ultrasound, MRI, PET, nuclear medicine. This would be 562.
It, this also faced considerable challenges in e-specification in the staging as well as in determining all of the studies that were done, which might not all be done at the same organization. So from at least an e-specification automated capture, this was a challenge for a provider. It might be more straightforward from a payer if you have access to all the claims around one patient. We also felt that this had a lower impact than many others, and that was part of the reason that in our programs it didn't get a high priority.
And, Frank, you wanted to know what imaging was included?
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. So it's chest X-ray, CT, ultrasound, MRI, PET, and nuclear medicine scans.
Kevin, was it a lower impact because of the sample?
Yeah, because stage one melanoma is not as nearly as prevalent as low back pain, for example. And so although in these cases probably there's overutilization, the incidence of stage one melanoma is much lower than some of the more common conditions that are on the list.
I guess what I'm asking is that statement applies to VA or does it apply to all patients?
No, this wasn't part of the VA. This was part of the ONC look at efficiency measures in general. So, again, this was not with the safety frame. This was with an efficiency frame. But as that our efficiency expert panel looked this one over, they said, you know, melanoma and costs around melanoma did not seem to be a high priority condition.
All right. That's what I needed. Thanks so much. So that one falls off unless someone wants to keep it on. Okay, the next is the prostate cancer avoidance of overuse of bone scans. I guess I have the same question. Is this got a staging issue with it?
It does have some staging issues with it. I think because it's a more common cancer, the commonness of it is what put this over the edge in the melanoma under the bar for inclusion in our thoughts about our programs. This was not as strongly endorsed by our panel as was, say, the measures around low back pain. But it did kind of make it over the bar from the efficiency panel, at least.
Richard?
I'd like to ask how unsafe is a bone scan? Is there substantial radiation or risk to the patient?
The bone scan has some of the – it's an X-ray of all your body. And so it's like a full-body X-ray. So whatever amount of X-ray exposure you get from a chest X-ray, now multiply that to your whole body. So it is more than you get in a routine x-ray by, I think, I don't know, I'm just guessing a factor of 5 or 10. But it's not a, it's not like getting radiation treatment. You know, it is like getting a number of x-rays.
So either we are all in total agreement or we are all exhausted. Barbara, you're both. Total agreement with exhaustion. There you go. Ron?
No, I'm just lost. Because, again, it's one thing to make these arguments from a utilization, misutilization, overutilization perspective, and there's a point to that. But we probably, as part of this committee, should really be thinking of the safety aspects to it. Let other committees do the other part. And so safety falls into generally a few different categories, but one is, was there a risk from the test? So again, biopsies and generally speaking, that's why I was interested about the CT dye, radiation exposure from either iodine exposure from the dye when you're allergic or radiation exposures that you brought up about bone scan, although it's relatively small. And we're not, these aren't classified in that sort of way. We're already evolving into talking about cost and utilization type stuff, although Frank tried to point out, no, it's really what's the safety side of things. And then the other thing is the risk of a false positive and or false negative. So if a test is overutilized and it results in more testing being done that didn't need to be, that represents a safety risk too because of the risk of the downstream stuff that's done. Obviously, if you don't do certain things that should be done and they represent a safety risk because a diagnosis was not found, like the back pain, some of the back pain doesn't get some kind of x-ray done within some period of time, there's a certain risk to not finding the cause of the back pain. That's kind of the perspective we should be adopting, but unfortunately the committee probably doesn't have, the data's not presented in that fashion, okay? We're not making decisions based on what is the false positive risk, what's the false negative risk, what's the risk of harm from the test, et cetera, et cetera. It's just kind of, we devolved, I would say, into kind of like, all right, is it a utilization issue? And I don't know how to do that with the data we're given here or where the cutting line would be. But certainly many of the tests we've talked about so far do represent some sort of radiation exposure risk, whatever that is. And then also the false positive, I mean, that we're not going to get that from the data that we're given, the risk of non-diagnosis, false positive, not false negative. So that's why I was getting rather lost. It almost is going to be we just take the procedure radiation ones and say yes and everything else no or something like that.
Kevin, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I actually really agree. I mean, I'm commenting partly on what we've had input from, which was in a different context. Part of how I frame this is that there's a certain inflection point when you reach no utility of the test, that all you have from it is risk. And so that risk could be very low, but if there is zero value from that test, then the only thing you're exposed to is risk, and you're never exposed. So there, it is an interesting question about the efficiency and safety interplay, because something that is all waste is necessarily only a risk exposure. Most things aren't all waste. It's a little bit hard to tell where that is, but it's a very good point and an interesting question.
So I think that's a very helpful comment to think about this in terms of what is the value of the study versus what is the risk of the radiation that's there. And I think I'm doing that in my mind with what I know. But and I think the fact that these are appropriateness measures tell you that, for the most part, As difficult as those are to come by, there's probably very limited value in most of these measures. And there's varying levels of risk. If you're, and that risk moves with age. You know, if you're 80 years old and you're exposed to CT, it's not a big risk factor. But if you're 5 years old and you're getting head bumps and you're getting repeat CT scans, it's a huge risk factor. So there's lots of things to consider here. Sean?
Frank, and I don't know if this is, I just want to follow up on Kevin's, because when we think about risks for these tests, there's both the risks of the false positive, which also, I would argue with you, increases with age rather than decreasing. But I think there's also the risk to patients in terms of time, in terms of money, in terms of bringing a family member to it, which do have safety issues associated with them. In my mind, as somebody who thinks about, you know, bringing a frail, demented patient to put them through a CT scan. So I do think there are real risks to them that we tend to sort of gloss over, but are real, particularly when, A, the test is not indicated because of appropriate issues, and, B, that the odds of us finding something from it keep approaching zero, because then I think those risks begin to increase more and more.
Great point. Really great point. So as I look through this, and just stop me so we don't have to walk through each one of them again, but if there's something that's – I'm going to tell you what I think's on the list, and that means everything else is off, and if I need to move it one way or the other, let me know. So on the list is the 052 low back pain. On the list is the inappropriate pulmonary CT for low risk PE. On the list was head CT and cervical spine radiography and CT, and both of those were in patients who were, according to protocol, were low risk. So that's what I have on the list, and we're kind of going with this balance of value versus risk and realizing there's lots of components to the risk. Off the list is, I'm sorry, I'm getting back to on the list. That's what I have, and we're up to prostate, and we had not put it on or off the list. So there were two left in this radiation theme. And that was prostate and nuclear medicine, bone scintigraphy. So I'm not hearing any reason to put those on, Sean.
Just a clarifying question. Does somebody have data the way Kevin did about what the rates are that would help guide us, whether this is a big problem or a small problem?
For prostate cancer, you mean?
I don't have it at all for nuclear medicine, and I think the prostate one is highly variable.
And I can try to dig into the work that we had Rand do for us. I don't have it off the top of my head, but they, as we did we did a day-long expert panel on this, and they've done a fair bit of background, so I can ask them.
I also have the data that was provided that just went through maintenance review. So they have the PQRS program that is reported in. 84.3% of patients that they reported on did not meet the measure, so performance is low. When you looked at the 10th percentile, it's 0%. Highest at the 90th percentile was 77.6 performance on the measure.
So what does that mean, 83% of the patients didn't need the study and got it anyway?
I got to read the measure again because this might be one of those reverse ones. So the patients who did not have a bone scan performed, so 83% of the time they got appropriate care. They didn't get it.
I'm not hearing a high demand for this one. And the last one is not currently endorsed. Did that fail endorsement? nuclear.
That one was just reviewed in the Cancer Project and is not recommended for continued endorsement.
Okay. So that takes us through the imaging list, and it brings us to now these medications, which is a little bit of a different kettle of fish. So we have recommended appropriate treatment for children with pharyngitis, recommended antibiotic treatment for adults with acute bronchitis avoidance of inappropriate use. Before I flip the page, those are for inclusion. Recommended appropriate treatment for children with upper respiratory infections. Okay.
You know, I couldn't find this measure. How is URI defined here? I can't find a measure to save my.
Give me a minute. They just resubmitted it, so I need to pull it up somewhere else.
This is 69 on our list. If that helps you.
Yes.
While we're waiting on that, low back pain, the appropriate use of epidural injections. So very specific indications for patients to get this. And then acute otitis externa, the systemic antimicrobial therapy, and the otitis media with infusion with corticosteroids. And I have one more on that list, and those are the 2 months to 12 years with diagnosis of otitis media externa who are not prescribed systemic antimicrobials. Andrea?
On the acute otitis externa, this is, I'm not sure exactly how this metric is couched, again, with all the potential details and how you might think about this, but there's certainly situations where you might need to give a kid systemic therapy, and depending on how that measure is framed, I wouldn't necessarily recommend this one. Sorry that I haven't seen the measure spec in more detail. The otitis media with the fusions and the steroids, I don't feel super strongly about that, although I think, the percentage of patients with otitis media with effusion who are not prescribed systemic antimicrobials, I just think that's a bit of a messy kettle of fish there, and the difference between whether you can really determine from charting whether what people are talking about with OME versus AOM, and I just don't think that it's worth going down that.
So let me ask you about these three measures, because there's, as I'm reading it, and I may be blending things I shouldn't, but these otitis media measures, there's three of them here. When we put forward the value-risk relationship, is there risk in these that we need to consider from a safety perspective?
I have not seen the data on how many patients are getting systemic antimicrobials for externa. It would have to believe that it's really low and limited to, like, you know, those really complicated, messy patients, you know, with other diseases that you can't clear it up and it's recurrent and they also have something else and they have cellulitis from the 50 bug bites plus the swimmer's ear. Like, you know, there's usually a reason if you're doing systemic antibiotics in that setting. So this is why, to me, it really depends massively on how that metric defines those exclusions, and that's what I would.
So there is a value proposition in here, and it's pretty murky.
Right. You could write those exclusions out, but it's, you know, there's reasons. There's reasons why you would use systemic antimicrobial, so there's a value proposition there. Otitis media with effusion, you know, the only, there's probably, I don't know what the numbers are of pediatricians who might still be using that. If you get into the ENT world, so once you have, like, some refractory OME, you know, I'm not too sure what happens at that point, so where does this metric get applied and that kind of thing. So the OME one, I think that's fine. You shouldn't be using steroids. You shouldn't, if you're diagnosing LME, but.
So you think that's a good safety measure?
I would want to, you know, I just don't know if you, once you've been referred to ENT, like what happens then? I just don't know the answer to that. There's a question in my mind about, is there ever a time when these kids should get steroids? And I just don't know that answer. So in the pediatric primary care setting, no. But if you have some really recurrent thing, you know, is there ever a time when it's appropriate? I'm not sure. So that would depend on how that metric is also written. And then, you know, percentage of patients age 2 to 12 with a diagnosis of otitis media with a fusion who were not prescribed systemic antimicrobials. I just think one of the issues is that how well do people really distinguish between OME and AOM? And what does that look like in documentation systems? And how are people really doing that clinically? So that in use, if you're just often just writing OM, and so where does this, how does this really play out in reality? I just think I would want to really see the field testing on this before and understand better the implications of that kind of a thing. Because, you know, the easiest way around it, if you wanted to give the kid antibiotics, would be to write it down as AOM, not OME. I mean, I think I'm just not sure that I'd want to see the field testing on these in a little
more
detail.
It just sounds like there's a lot more about appropriateness here and a lot less about safety.
But we're in the appropriateness category. Oh, well, no, there's safety issues. So you give the kid amoxicillin, it turns out they're penallergic. You give them something else, and they come back the next day with Stevens-Johnson. They get diarrhea, they get C. diff. Some of these kids, you know, before these guidelines came out, kids used to get these antibiotics.
Assuming no adverse drug events, it's just the safety issue of over-treatment versus all the appropriateness issues.
Adverse drug events, the potential other complications, what have you, cost.
Okay.
Right.
So I'm just not hearing you give me safety. I'm hearing you give me a lot of appropriateness stuff.
I mean, driving, this is what has been thought to drive the resistance of bacteria in the environment, right? So it's a big, in that way, so this is driving resistant organisms, and that's why a lot of these things.
Well, that's the safety side of this. And if you had to balance all that appropriateness stuff you just said versus the resistant organisms, where are we? Is it really a problem with resistance and we need to put this on the safety list? Or does all that complexity of appropriateness of care supersede the resistance issue? That's the value risk proposition right there.
If these metrics are framed properly, then I think the value risk balance is appropriate for us to consider them. If they're not framed with the appropriate exclusions, then I do not think so. So that's what I'm getting at. Sorry.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, we trust the endorsement process to tell us they're framed appropriately. We can't go back and look at specking out every measure through an endorsement. We can't repeat that. So we're assuming endorsement to this cause is right. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure you're convinced where this lies in your mind. And until you are, it's hard for us to be, I think. Richard?
Just wanted to ask a question if there was a difference between the antibiotics and the corticosteroids and whether there might be more risk. I know in the adult population you would have risk of inducing diabetes and sleep disturbance and all kinds of different.
Oh, yeah, you give a kid steroids and they're, like, off the wall. I mean, yeah. So, definitely think that there is a risk to giving those medications. There's no question about that.
Amy?
I guess kind of given what I'm hearing from you, I'm not hearing like, wow, this is rampant, this is something that's causing a lot of problems, definitely. I'm thinking in the interest of, is that word again, parsimony, are these really things we want to include in the core measure set? I mean, do they rise to that level of impact and important?
I mean, it sounds like it's important in the pediatric set, but I'm not sure it's a safety issue. And there's so much complexity of what Andrea was saying, I'm less inclined to say it's safety.
and more inclined to say it's off over here in routine pediatric appropriateness. Unless there's an objection, let's move on then. I'm sorry, Laura. Use your mic.
Back to the pharyngitis and bronchitis measurement. We do measure those in the health plan. And it's just, I would just echo what Kevin said about the coding, because a lot of times we have a very low pharyngitis rate. It's like 13%. But I think it's because they're not coding the otitis media, or they're not picking up that coding, which would be appropriate then for the antibiotic. And we find that a lot. They're not coding it correctly and are following the guidelines, or B, we've also heard that they're not following the guidelines, and they just think it's, you know, pharyngitis and it's really a viral. So I'm just saying that just to put the caution of the coding issue on the table for all three of those measures.
Wait, I didn't realize those were dependent on coding.
All of them use ICD-9 coding for the denominator, for the most part. The pharyngitis one and the URI ones are both administrative claims. The OME and the AOE are actually using the PQRS program, so they're claims as well.
Amy, is yours up? Okay. So then I have we're down into the procedures, where we've got, nobody mentioned the surgical timing and low back pain, and then we get into endoscopy surveillance, which were process measures for appropriate follow-up interval in normal and in average risk patients. And interval and history of adenomas followed patients.
Sorry, I missed this page. I liked actually all three of these measures, so I just was an oversight on my part.
Even though it says red flag under low
back
pain.
Yes, I know, for the low back pain. Partly, again, wearing my hat of trying to find measures for lots of programs, we struggle for surgical measures. And so we actually have a pile of primary care measures, and we have only a handful of measures in surgical programs, so we often put a little different hat on for surgical measures just because the measure set is less mature.
This is also one you're not expecting zero on.
Correct.
Okay. And then there's the two polyp surveillance ones. Richard?
Yeah, so I guess to the last point, I understand without knowing if there's a red flag, it might be a good screening measure, and you'd want to know more about that. But when you start comparing individual practitioners without the real clinical knowledge behind it, you risk really alienating the practitioner. I think the practitioner will be on board with good, actionable data, and probably you can really impact change that way. But if you start putting out data that doesn't have the so-called red flags and that is appropriate, I think you run the risk of having the thing backfire. So without that, I'm not sure you want to do cross-comparison. And with the last two, I was a little surprised because, well, it seems like a lot of work to go through this endoscopy, colonoscopy, just to know if it's been documented in their report. I'd kind of like to know how many had follow-up colonoscopy within a 10-year window, which would be an inappropriate overutilization if there were negative findings on the first one, right? So it just seems like this is not where we need to be.
Sean?
Yeah, two comments. I actually like the low back pain measure just because of the real safety issues and the clear guidelines for that. And I was struck by the procedural one, and Richard, thank you for pointing this out. I actually thought it was performance of the procedure rather than a recommendation. And so I was actually going to say these are great. But if it is clearly just a recommendation, it doesn't get at what I would like to see.
I'm sorry, is the
second one a recommendation, the 659?
I couldn't tell, Frank. I just interpreted. I was moving them one to the other because they were they looked like they were the same.
The 658 is clearly
It's clearly, yeah.
Heidi, can you tell me if 659 is a recommendation?
So the this measure is coming up for maintenance, so it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But it's patients who received a surveillance colonoscopy with a history of a prior polyp, and then it's patients who had an interval of 3 or more years since their last colonoscopy. This one, though, is using, it's not claims data, it's using CPT-2. So it's slightly different, I think, than what everybody was thinking the measure was.
This is 659.
Yeah.
So 658 is more of a process, did you recommend? And seems like a soft call here. 659 is looking through CPT-2 at the interval. For those who had a history of adenomatous polyps, did they have an appropriate interval? So that one is getting closer to safety. I, as the colorectal surgeon, would say 658 is bunk, and that's a technical term of art, and I like 659. I think patients need to know that we're looking at the right intervals. I think it would help everybody. I'm not so sure that we understand what the intervals are anymore. They keep changing, but we'll do our best to try and keep up with the right interval. So I'm in favor also of the timing measure for neurosurgery. I think the low back pain is a good timing measure. So if that's okay, we've got the low back pain timing is in, 658 is not, 659 is in. All right.
Can I go back to the OME metrics?
Oh, sure.
I just pulled up the guidelines on this. Just to, the so I'm okay with the steroids one and the antibiotic one for OME. So that's.
Could you give the numbers, please?
656 and 657.
Good with 656 and 657, but not with 654.
I didn't look up that. I'll look at that. Give me
okay.
A couple more minutes.
All right. Well, while you're looking that up, then.
Can I make another
sure.
Comment maybe around GAP for all of these measures?
We're on GAP. That's where we're going.
Is it possible that they can all be directionally made to be the same? I don't know if is that physically possible or not, because, or technically, whatever the word is. It's so confusing whether you want high performance or low performance in some of these, and I don't know if it's always sort of P and, you know, 1 minus P. Or
it's a common question that comes up through the endorsement process we see often. There are varying reasons why they may do it one way or the other. There's been no true policy that's come out of the CTAC or the board on which way they would prefer to see it. I think the one thing is you want to make sure it's very clear when you are reporting something that should look like everyone would assume is high, which actually should be low. You have to clearly state that. There's not been anything more than that, but it's a common question that everyone asks and a concern everyone has.
Gaps.
This is Kevin. In this same room about 6 weeks ago, I was with the American College of Surgeons, and they were talking about measures that they wanted. And they were really looking to work together to build some surgical measures of safety. And so I would actually look to that group and ask them what they wanted. They wanted to focus on surgical site infections, actually, and think about a suite of measures that would be appropriate for use by a number and variety of surgeons for different reasons around surgical site infections.
Okay. party to that group. I don't know who you're hanging out with, but boy, you got to be suspect. We actually did that in a lot of yesterday, and we did not mention the effort I think you're referring to is the effort we're trying to do in terms of defining data elements and linking registries across into these actual measures.
Yeah, and I think it was also making sure that there was a surgical site infection, and maybe if you talked to this yesterday, I won't go into it too much, but to make sure that they were covered for all different types of surgeons, to make sure that the ophthalmologists and the ENTs and the different kinds of people had surgical site infection measures appropriate for their types of surgery.
We did not go into that, but thanks for mentioning that. I've got Sean and then Sheck.
We're on gas now, right, Frank?
We're on gas.
I'm sorry, I'm really tired, and I just may be fading in and out.
We're on gas.
Two gaps just to bring forward to the table. One is ASCO's recent work on, you know, I'll be facetious, but fifth-line chemotherapy agents, and that's been missing here. The second, which is a big-picture issue, which we're seeing more and more in palliative care, which I don't know how to sort of put a spin around, but it's treatments not matched to goals. And the safety, there's a couple of big safety issues here, but, you know, to give it just sort of a concrete example, we have a 14-bed inpatient palliative care unit, and of the patients that we're seeing now, every single one of them needs a private room because they have antibiotic-resistant bacteria because of the multiple antibiotics they receive in the setting of chronic illness, which were not beneficial to them. And it's just become a huge issue for us. But that's just sort of an example. But
could you be explicit about treatment not matched to goals?
Sure. Patients who do not have their goals of care clearly identified receive routine, what we typically think of as routine hospital-based treatments that may not match their goals. And that can include, you know, multiple intravenous antibiotics, ICU care, intubation.
Does that make sense? Yeah, I just want to make sure we're all on the same page, that this is patient goals, physician treatment. They got to be matched. Great. Ron?
This is a dangerous category because if you think about overdiagnosis, undiagnosis, misutilization, not doing appropriate follow-up testing for certain populations, there's a whole plethora of gaps that could be in here. So, I mean, we focus on a very few fields. But, I mean, pap smears in people that have normal pap smears, mammograms in people that have previously abnormal mammogram, that's just, you know, oncology. But get into cardiac cath in people who have chest pain that isn't really chest pain. If you really want to go down this path, which is why it's a very dangerous path, yes, I can make a safety argument for most of those. But it's going to explode really quickly. And I think somehow we have to, when you call for gaps, or when you identify gaps, somehow you have to recognize that this is a wide open area.
So we're specifically looking for the low-value, high-risk gap area. Where those two start, you know, offsetting each other, we're getting a field. So that's the area. Sheck?
Yeah, I just wanted to echo, I think Sean and both Kevin talked about the antibiotic stewardship issue and overuse of antibiotics, but also pain management and then sedatives and the use of sedatives and antibiotics. So I don't know. I mean, we were talking about the kind of high-risk, low appropriateness issue, but I think that's another area.
To that end, I think there's an opportunity to harmonize with what the states are doing as more and more states are looking at this.
Yes, this is Kevin. I agree. I think chronic pain management and non-cancer pain management with chronic opioids might be an interesting place. There's a lot of data to show those people end up in the ER if not well managed, and probably a lot of overuse.
Great. Richard?
I think this could be a safety argument, but it's certainly a patient-centered argument, and that is I think there is a lot of potential for overutilization, and I think possibly this bears on safety. But overutilization from failure to ascertain end-of-life decisions, I think we put patients through a lot of invasive and uncomfortable procedures because we haven't ascertained really what the preferences are. And so that, to me, is a huge gap. I know there's a lot of trepidation and approach.